Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Robert Bounds. Now, a couple of years ago, the British writer Max Porter published his breakout hit novella, Grief is the Thing with Feathers. The story followed a father and his two young sons after the death of their mother and a Ted Hughes-inspired crow that came tumbling into the family's life as that thing with feathers. It was a poetic, poignant and funny take on how a family copes with the death of a parent and was such a success that there's now a stage production of it starring Cillian Murphy. Now, Porter has released a second book called Lanny, which focuses on a small village on the periphery of London where a small boy goes missing. The book follows a similar structure to Grief is the Thing with Feathers as various characters, both real and mythical, take on the narrative every few pages, revealing the conversations, tensions, crimes and folklore of this very English semi-rural setting. To discuss Lanny with me today are the Deputy Features Editor at the London Evening Standard, Susanna Butter, and John Mitchinson, founder and publisher of Unbound. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we're going to take the bull by the horns, possibly. In the kind of country we live in at the moment, or in the kind of stuff that's constantly in the news, to-ing and fro-ing, we see kind of a bit of a split country. There's lots of splits in this book, in the narrative and the way words are used and all the rest of it. John, do we see contemporary tensions kind of writ large in Lanny, or are they kind of subtle and under the surface, if they're there at all?
I suppose not writ large in a kind of, you know, Jonathan Coe State of a Nation yeah. way. But they're definitely there, and they're, I think, exquisitely. This book is I have to say, a very, very beautiful work of literary art, as much as it is also a fine bit of storytelling. But so built into the narrative, as you say, are all these kind of conflicts. It's set in a commuter village, sort of an hour from London. A young family, Lanny, who is this strange, slightly pan-like child who wanders through the countryside freely and sings and draws. And then his parents, father's a commuter, mother is a novelist writing really kind of grim, dark crime fiction. There's the town versus country split. You get lots of voices of people in the village, hostile neighbours. There's the mad artist, Pete, who adopts Lanny as a friend and companion. And you also get the kind of, I mean, without giving too much of the plot away, the child, Lanny, disappears, and the horror of that brings about a kind of, I think, a brilliant dissection of what happens, how the media feeds off tragedy in people's lives. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, you get the kind of the sort of tensions that we're seeing bubbling to the surface through Brexit when Pete the artist is beaten up because he's suspected of having abducted the child. So it's very, very, it's not in any way remotely political, but you do feel that there is a kind of a version of England that is being argued yeah. over in this book at a very kind of literally at a fundamental level. That's just the surface of the story. Yeah. Underneath.
Well, there's all sorts of stuff bubbling underneath.
Oh, yes.
That was sort of part of the folklore we talked about in the introduction. Susanna, let's tackle some of that folklore. And it's in the character of Dead Papa Toothwort.
Good name.
And also, I think, Peggy, who's kind of a bit like the sort of blind seer of Thebes or yeah. something, who is kind of becomes one with some of the sort of fences of the village and her garden gate and all the rest of it. She yeah. sort of like channels it. What about the folklore element? This was in Max Porter's first novel as well. How does that bear itself out, Susanna?
It's through interludes, which are written in a different way, and Dead Papa Toothwort kind of goes on quite trippy
yeah.
sort of streams of consciousness, and they can...
He could definitely... I think he was kind of like the unsung third member of the KMS or something.
Yeah, just free word association, but yeah. it's cleverer than that. That's almost the controversial bit of the book. You might say that it's a bit inaccessible, and they're actually printed in a way that is rather beautiful. They curve around the page, and
it's very unusually put together, isn't it?
It looks a bit like yeah. a typo at points, words running into each other, but in a way that's what makes it brilliant, because you just don't drop off. Just as you're kind of easing into the story, you get this Dead Papa Toothwort interlude, and you wonder what's going on, but you're kind of beguiled by it at the same time, and bits of it are funny, and it relates to village life, and it has sentences like Susan's salted caramel cake is delicious, and then it can yeah. go into something quite aggressive.
Yeah, and that's an amazingly powerful kind of device. That's the sort of experimental half of the novel, isn't it?
Yeah,
and then the other part is quite
formal and structured and kind of first person, isn't it? It's told through the Lanny's mum, Lanny's father, etc.
Well, he does a clever thing. That's sort of three sections to the book. The first one is you know, you're clearly told that the monologue that you're in is Lanny's mum or Pete the artist, or these, as you say, the wonderful sinuous, organic looking. You realise that I haven't seen this in a book before, but the rectilinear quality of prose is changed in front of your eyes because they curve and weave these lines of dead Papa Toothwort all over the page. And then the second part of the book is you feel the sense of foreboding that something bad is going to happen, and indeed what happens, Lanny disappears. And then the second bit is it's much more difficult. You're getting lots and lots of shorter fragments when you're inside different people's heads. And then the third bit gets pretty phantasmagoric towards the end when you're being shown the possible endings of the book. And you watch Max Porter himself, having set up, you know, one of the oldest kind of, you know, tropes of fiction, the loss of a child, the search for a child. How is the child alive or is it dead? And how does Max Porter himself as a writer get himself out of that that particular hole?
The sort of genre hole.
Yeah, I think he just does it brilliantly.
Yeah. What about that, Susanna? The kind of like his mum, so the Lanny's mum is, as John said, writes these kind of quite, or is writing quite a kind of macabre, but kind of classic kind of splashy crime fiction novel. And then the son disappears, Lanny disappears in the book. How does he hop out of the genre hole?
You kind of wonder who to trust with all the voices. Yeah. Yeah. And you wonder if you're somehow complicit in it. And there's one bit where it's told from a neighbour's point of view, observing the mum. And I sort of sympathise with her because she's left alone in this big house in the countryside that she hasn't necessarily wanted to move. Well, countryside, suburbia. It's trying to be countryside. that she hasn't necessarily wanted to move to. And she's struggling with writing crime fiction and wondering how to talk about that with her son, who's seemingly innocent. And then you see it from the neighbour's point of view and you're not meant to like the neighbour, but you wonder if there's truth in that. And you feel a bit complicit.
And the dad's interesting as well. The voice
the dad's
of the father.
Brilliant. He was
the dad's,
my favourite.
Yeah, and there was a really good interview with Max Porter in The Guardian. I think it was the last couple of weeks, I'm sure, since the novel's come out, where he was talking about wanting to write a kind of just an everyday, or, you know, a believable father figure or bloke figure, as it were. You know, and he kind of looks at porn on his mobile phone, but he's obviously, he's kind of a very good husband in some ways, but he's kind of stuck. He kind of almost feels glad to have to get on the 7:21 to Waterloo so that he can kind of escape the countryside that he's moved to as a sort of form of aspiration. He can't escape the escapism he's dreamed of. He's quite a complex person, but written very straight, as it were. He's quite, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a guy, I kind of thought there was some brave truth in it, perhaps.
Well, which is, I mean, all makes the book in a way all the more remarkable because he's a very believable character, the dad. I mean, all the characters, I think, are, despite the fragmentary nature, they're very, very accurately sketched and are believable. But then you have, you know, I live in a village, so I feel this quite this sense of the past and of a certain amount of sinister stuff. You know, that dead Papa Toothwort is an amazingly I mean, it's a brilliant bit of writing, but it's also just as an idea, all the sort of rubbish and the dirt and the lives that have seeped into these places. There's a wonderful scene towards the end where they talk about the village hall having, you know, smelling of kind of, you know, all the celebrations and the flower shows and the things. Really vivid.
Smelly plimsolls.
Yeah,
all the
exactly.
He village hall smells.
He manages to write imaginatively about the facts of village life, the cliches of village life, but at the same time, you have this dark kind of green man energy. It's bits of it. There are times when it reminded me very much of Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. The other times when it reminded me of Paul Kingsnorth's book The Wake. Just the sense of menace. And that, you know, the countryside isn't always just there for, you know, middle-class people who commute to London to get their kind of, you know, their five a day of landscape and communion with nature, that there's a lot more going on in there. And indeed, some of the menace in the pub conversations and the violence that erupts at various points. It's difficult to compare it to anything, absolutely, but there are things that it certainly reminds me of.
Yeah, and there is that sort of, as you say, dead papa tooth works into a certain extent with Peggy standing on her garden gate, who's kind of, again, he's kind of like a bit like Mad Pete. People kind of diss her in the village. You know, she's Mad Peggy that will always try and have a conversation with you, and people kind of go the long way round, so they don't have to walk past her garden gate and be subject to her supposed ramblings. And then, of course, you realise they're kind of quite specific truths a lot of the time as the book goes on. There's a kind of a folk horror element to both of those.
I mean, folk horror for sure. You're only two or three paces away from the Wicker Man.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Exactly.
And that tension and anxiety of a small community, you notice more when they're all together and concentrated.
And you talked about the way the book is printed, Susanna, the way that, you know, and as the different voices of people in the pub snatches a conversation on the bus as you walk past someone in the street, etc., etc., all kind of, as the novel progresses, they get all more and more jumbled up together. And they're interesting because they're kind of somewhere like somewhere like between a Twitter feed, the ramblings of Rowley Birkin QC from The Far Show sitting by his fireside, and I suppose the sort of village notice board, aren't they? And obviously overheard pub conversations and all the rest of it. But they're really funny, as you say, and very truthful. And that kind of obviously gives you, that's almost like switching through the bands on an FM radio.
Exactly that,
you get to see, you get to bore down into the feelings of the village.
And the very simple impulses, like someone just wanting chicken wrapped in bacon and forgetting it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and the kind of like, I don't know, and the judgment. And it starts off with kind of like, you know, someone saying, oh, he's had, you know, one too many gin and tonics, or, you know, I wish so-and-so would fall under a bus, but probably not meaning it. So they're becoming quite dark and macabre and echoing the stuff that's happening kind of underneath with dead Papa Toothwort and the rest of it. I realised that wasn't a question. It was just me agreeing with something you said earlier. There you go. Sometimes that happens. I wanted to talk about how he writes the children, how he wrote, Max Porter wrote his first book, and how he does this one, how he handles children. Lanny doesn't have a voice in this. You just hear what he says and how he is.
You don't even know how old he is, I don't think.
No.
It's just general.
You kind of feel like he's less than, you feel like he's maybe 9 or something, 9 or 10, you know, he's kind of, but he's, he's quite an innocent.
Yeah.
And I wonder how stylized he seems.
I don't know. I mean, again, you're always trying to resist the cliches, but I do think that the device of not giving Lanny a voice almost makes his voice clearer. It's, again, brilliantly done because it's the projections, which is, of course, what we all do with children is we project onto them. You know, he can be annoying. You know, he's given to gnomic senses. So he asks his dad, "What's more patient, a hope or a dream?" And his dad just stop being weird, Lanny. You know, but then his relationship with Pete and his obviously also his relationship, you have to say, with Peggy and with Papa Toothwort, that they are picking up on his frequency. I think he's a. I think he's kind of on one level, he has to function as a sort of an ideal of the innocence of childhood. But you get a very strong sense of the collection of objects in his room. And he makes this incredible bower in the woods, which, you know, he gets bullied at school. Again, you know, sort of fairly standard. But he is a very joyful child and sort of wise beyond his years. Obviously, you know, the book sort of runs on that idea that he's connected to something that maybe his parents don't quite understand.
And he absorbs things in a way that his parents don't quite realise. Suddenly he'll be asking them questions about the planets or something and they might not know. And that way that children do.
And that sort
you don't
of wisdom, accidental wisdom of kids kind of thing.
And
you'd
wonder if they get the significance of it, but then you don't want to patronise them.
I mean, there's that brilliant moment where the mum loses. She's been put through. The mother is put through the kind of McCann mill, you know. Are these people fit parents because they let him roam in a latchkey kid? And then she's, you know, there's a think piece from a journalist in the book, which I think is brilliantly done, where they wonder whether she's an accomplished performer, but I'm not sure I buy into this performance. I think that Lanny emerges as a kind of, there's a sort of maybe on the spectrum nature to what he does. But when they find the letters and she explodes at the because she only discovers through being interviewed that they've got these letters, incredibly moving. And of course, the letters are sort of fragmentary and very Papa Toothworthy in what they...
Yeah, that he's channeling a voice that kind of you feel like can't be his as a 9-year-old boy or a young.
Which, of course, again is amazing because I was immediately put in mind of As I Lay Dying, you know, which has another structure with people having incredibly articulate, beautiful, poetic, and you know, a lot of the people said then, these guys are just hillbillies. They couldn't be thinking these thoughts. But yeah. That's what fiction can do.
Let's talk about language. Max Porter in that interview said he loved sort of proper language, formal language, slang, hip-hop, and you know, snatches overheard on the train and things like this. There's a lot of that in this. There's a lot of things that there is it's a great stylish and stylized mashup of stuff, I suppose. Can you see, Susanna, where he's kind of getting where he's getting this stuff from? I kind of feel like he is on the train from London to Bath to visit his publishers to his new house in the countryside, writing snippets of people's conversations down, as I'm sure we all want to. But do you know what I mean? Can you imagine how he's written this?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Can you imagine how he's kind of written this?
It's so well observed, isn't it? I read that people said it was like Under Milk Wood.
Yeah.
But then he hadn't read Under Milk Wood.
Yeah, right.
So, there's obviously something in that culture, and that's what makes it feel very topical, because it's taking in strands of Green Man theory and village mythology, it's also so relatable, and he seems to know human impulses, and lots of the people are quite in their heads, like the mum alone all day and the dad on his train gaming his commute. But he gets it, clearly, doesn't he? I wonder if he does keep little notes.
Yeah, I kind of feel like...
It does feel that you I just love it. Snatches. Glenda and I are withdrawing our support for the Bell Rope. Agricultural consultancy, my arse. Bunning with Oscar, you should come along. Before the bypass, you could watch the progs make their merry way. Worst plant sale in a decade.
Yeah.
And so it goes.
Some of it's the archers and some of it's and some of it is like a sort of kind of robust Twitter feed, isn't it?
It is, but I think that idea of picking up sort of tooth waters, there's some sort of weird kind of radio station. He's able to get inside. He's able to shape-shift. He can be the milk pouring down Lanny's throat into his stomach, and he can be on the outside. At one point, he just appears as a sort of regular geezer walking down the street.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant device. Susanna and I were just saying before, the book is being filmed. I have no idea how they're going to film Toothwort.
Yeah. Rachel Weisz, so it would be good if she was playing Toothwort.
Yeah.
Yeah, unlikely.
Right. You feel like she might not be, sadly. But yeah, it is. He is an amazing device, and he is Lanny is the titular character. But I kind of feel like Dead Papa Toothwort could manipulate any of these people. He's just zoned in on one person that he finds attractive. It comes up. He sort of says, you know, it happens every 100 years or so. I just can't help myself.
He
comes up through the sewers and through the drains and kind of down the chimneys like a bit of a chimera, also a sprite when he's on good behaviour.
It's like a 21st century reimagining of Tom Bombadil, the controversial character from Lord of the Rings that they decided to leave out of the films because it was too weird. I sort of feel that Max is tapping into that kind of that energy, that sort of it's a kind of Gaia like latent, but brilliantly not making it kind of soppy.
Yeah,
I mean, Tom Bombadil's poetry is the most skipped bits, I would imagine, of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
But there's some strange thematic connection there.
Then it's rooted by the dad, who's almost Alan Partridge.
poor old Robert Lloyd.
When he's comparing his commute to being on a horse.
He's really good. That is really good, isn't it?
They're awesome. He's brilliant. There's one bit where his day's going really well and he's got a nice bottle of wine and he's getting his favourite meal.
Yeah, get in.
Get in.
Win it.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of reminded me of, parts of it reminded me of Ali Smith's two seasonal novels so far in her four, I suppose. Bits of kind of, not magic realism, but bits of kind of fantasy and strangeness and kind of tapping down into sort of paganism, unusual and unlikely things happening, and then lots of reported speech and real kind of the formal bits of it being exceptionally kind of locked down and where you know exactly where you are in a story and exactly what people kind of think and things, and then kind of drifting off satisfyingly into something more, not whimsical, but something more stylized, I suppose. There's something of that. It made me realise how much I'm looking forward to spring, actually, as well. Both literally and literally. Shall we head off into the pastures for further reading? Susanna, this reminded you of Reservoir 13, John McGregor's book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was partly because I was thinking about Lanny, and I've not read that many nature books that kind of get fantastical. So I was thinking there probably is something really fantastical and nature-based, but I haven't read it. So I'll go with the simple theme of the missing child, but done in an original, engaging way. And I think John McGregor's Reservoir 13 does that. It's different because it's a girl who goes missing. And I think traditionally, when the media fixates on a missing child, it often it is the stories about the girls that become more sensationalised and identified with. But it's similar in that it's an outsider. In Reservoir 13, it's a little girl on holiday with her parents. So they've got that separate perspective on a village that's been going the same way with the same intentions for years and years. And John McGregor also writes in a very lyrical, very identifiable social observation style way, shifting between the perspectives. It's more realistic, Reservoir 13, but it's got similar mix of characters, and you've got kind of the old person who sits back observing, and people maybe underestimate them.
And I suppose it's I don't even know whether we would say it's a genre novel. It is maybe a novel that tackles the genre of the missing child, I suppose, maybe. And the kind of realism of the writing is an interesting one. I think Max Porter talks about this as well, wanting to not have to tell people what colour the policeman's hair was, or if they had a cup of coffee or tea when they sat down in the suspect's living room or whatever. And how does John McGregor do that in Reservoir 13? What's the universe of the writing?
He kind of shows you rather than telling you. So people go back and they have memories, and they have this starting point of the missing child, but they actually talk about marriages that have gone wrong, or how people met, or the strain of their job. And it's just a lot of them remembering.
And it's kind of the fallout of how this loss affects the village that the girl comes from, as much as it's about the girl and the family specifically.
Yeah, and what it highlights in the village.
And that you can kind of see that. You can see that in Lanny, that you see the kind of off-the-cuff pub banter turning into kind of accusation. You can see a village hardening in its views, I suppose, centred around something sort of tragic, which we call tragic in inverted commas, but it's only tragic for possibly three people in the novel that we're talking about, Lanny, right? It's a tough one. Ridley Walker, John. this has been on my list for ages to read. I haven't got round to it yet. I know Reservoir 13 is recent and is eminently Googleable. Ridley Walker is a slightly different proposition.
It is. It's a 1980 novel, usually classified as sci-fi, which is fine. I mean, it's set.
I can see that annoys you.
Well, it's set in the future. I sometimes think it would, if you don't like sci-fi, and there are a lot of people who don't.
There's no spaceships.
Wrongly,
in
my view, then this book, this is, I think, a stone cold classic of 20th century literature. And in a way, I think because it's an experimental novel, to use that sort of dreaded word. It feels like it's in a lineage that contains Max Porter's work as well. I have no idea whether Max has read Russell Hoban, but everybody should. The book is the thing that's probably most known about is it's written in an invented version of Kentish dialect. The world has basically been destroyed, and the world that we know it has been destroyed, but it's left in fragments, bits of machinery. And the book is narrated by a young man called Ridley Walker, who is, without the plot really kind of isn't the point, but he uncovers through this incredibly, rather like Lanny, particularly the tooth work bits, the language slows down your reading, so you have to really pay attention, and it's just the most rich,
fragmentary language. Yeah, right? it takes language to pieces, and it's
rich. It's totally doable by five or six pages. You get into the rhythm of it, and the state and the church have become one. It's sort of there's a sort of strange mythology that's grown up that again is fed by a lot of the pagan Celtic mythology that you can feel it's sort of underneath Lanny. The plot, as I say, is about an attempt to rebuild a weapon from the past. It opens with this extraordinary boar hunt. They're living essentially in an ice age kind of version of Britain. They're living with very little technology, you know, sort of cobbling things together out of things that they don't know. But just for that kind of linguistic inventiveness. One of the big bits of their religion that survived is Punch and Judy. So Punch and Judy has become this kind of...
This is how they talk about history, and they talk about... They kind of try to... It's also like the village voice, kind of village poet,
And Ridley, again, is, a special young person. You know, he's got gifts and he sees things that other people don't. And he is kind of an unreliable narrator, as most first person narrators are. But it builds to, I mean, it's a very, very moving climax in the book, which, again, by the time you're in this linguistic world, I mean, it's very difficult to go back to, right. to other, because you know you want more Ridley, you want more of the stories. It's again, the stories based weirdly. I think Russell Hoban was inspired by a medieval wall painting of St. Eustace. St. Eustace becomes the kind of the sort of the god figure. But again, all of this pulling together of linguistic inventiveness and deep kind of narrative originality, you know, playing with the structure of plots. I also loved, I have to say, I thought Reservoir 13 was a brilliant book. But I think there's definitely, both Ridley Walker and Lanny show what I think truly inspired writer can do with plot, and to turn it into something that, you know, by the end of Lanny, you're not really sure what you've read. Is it? I mean, it's incredibly moving, and I would say the same thing about Ridley Walker. So you have been manipulated, you've been taken on a journey, and you've been fed deep, rich ideas. Both Ridley Walker and Lanny are books that I would read again and again. Not sure I would read Reservoir 13 again, but I mean, it's beautifully written.
And is that addictive quality? Is that about the stylized nature of some of it, because there is something satisfying to get your head around, to get your teeth into, rather than simply knowing the story and knowing the ending, if you know what I mean? Where a more realistic novel is more about the plot, perhaps, even if it's beautifully well sketched, it is more about the plot and the story and there being an ending, a satisfying ending to it, rather than something where the universe is very satisfying to inhabit. I found it a very satisfying, I wish it was a longer book. I sort of devoured it in one go. And then when I was reading it on the train coming in this morning, again, I really got into it and almost didn't get off, you know, at the right point. Because it's very satisfying to inhabit.
And there's something about the length that helps, I think. It's like the shorter TV series. When you know there's only so much, you really concentrate. Whereas it's kind of not intimidating. You can just take it in your pocket on the tube and then just inhabit this completely beguiling world and go back to it because, you don't feel scared by its weight.
Yeah,
I have a theory. I know Max is a very, he's a very good publisher as well as an amazing writer. I just wonder that there's a sort of sense in which what he's done is, as a publisher, you do have to read so much flabby, conventional stuff, even if you're working as fine a publisher as Granta, which was where Max was until recently. And I sort of feel that you can feel that he wants to tell, everybody, every novelist wants to tell a story that people will be engaged by. But he also wants to go deeper. And the sort of shortness, I think you're right, Susanna, it works because it doesn't feel, it's not like picking up Finnegan's Wake and thinking, will it be this year? Will this be the year? And putting it back down again. Yeah. Only of my friends, only Andy Miller has ever got through Finnegan's Wake. But, this is a book. First thing I wanted to do is to go right back to the beginning and start reading it again. And a number of reviewers have said that it's a book that yields up more, I think, because it is so, it's short, but it's incredibly dense.
And he creates such a mood and a world that drives it.
I loved living in the world of Lanny because of its weirdnesses and despite its sadness.
And it's not as dark as Reservoir 13.
No.
You don't kind of want to finish it so that you can move on with your life and have closure.
I had a slight Breaking Bad thing with me with Reservoir. Yeah. It was exactly that. I want to be out of this now.
Yeah. But not so Lanny. Thank you both very much indeed. That brings us to the end of today's show. Lanny by Max Porter is out now. It's published by Faber and Faber. Thanks to my guests John Mitchinson and Susanna Butter, and to my producer Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.